Hi, everybody. Alan Arnett here with another podcast on alanarnett.com. And look who is my regular guest. We got to stop meeting like this, Adrian.
I'm happy to be a regular. We should do it in person, though. That's got to be the next step.
That would be fun. It's Thursday, May 26th. And Adrian Bollinger, of course, the co-founder of Alpenglow Expeditions, is just fresh off of setting a record. You know, I've been joking about this entire season across the Himalaya that there's more records than in a 1950s jukebox. I mean,
lots,
it's just
records.
It's just crazy how much is going on this year. But yeah. you did something that was that, first off, no one has ever done before, obviously, a record. I was just looking at the Himalayan database and I wanted to get all my facts straight here. But you made the first true ski descent on Makalu.
That's right. Fifth tallest mountain in the world. Actually, my third expedition trying to ski it. I tried for the first time in 2012 and then again in 2015. And it was one of 2 8,000 meter peaks left that hadn't had sort of a true ski descent. So I'm pretty excited to have finally gotten to make it happen.
When I started looking at the other guys that had tried, I mean, you know, there's a who's who list of world-class climbers, four from Italy, one from Austria, but Johan Kamelander, I guess. Most of them they didn't actually ski from the summit. They started to ski from around maybe 7,500 meters or something like that.
Yeah, right. So, you know, Makalu, the normal route, what we call the normal route, it's got a pretty notable kind of shift on the mountain at the Makalu La at 7,450 meters. And so the mountain had certainly been skied from that height even before I started trying in 2012. And that's the height I skied it from in 2012. That's as high as we got. In 2015, we actually skied from almost 8,000 meters above Camp 4. So that was the highest it had been skied. But of course, the goal is to ski off the summit, right? And
right.
We might get into details that, you know, an important kind of like caveat to my ski. I actually did not ski off the true summit. I started my ski from probably 15-ish meters below the true summit, 50 feet below the true summit. So that last 45 feet still remains for someone to do a better job in the future. You know, I joke about that, but I do think it's really important. Like as this sport becomes more and more popular, of 8,000 meter peak climbing and style, there's such a huge spectrum of style of climbing in the Himalaya now. And I think it's very important, especially if we are making careers out of it, being sponsored athletes, being influencers, talking about our accomplishments and our records. Those little asterisks we all have at the end of our climbs or skis, they have to be incredibly clear. And so the fact that I skied from 45 feet below the summit, that is different. And so I just want to get it out there right away.
Well, I appreciate that integrity, Adrian, that it... Because it's just like the whole Manaslu controversy about the four summit versus the true summit and all of that. And, you know, and it goes, I mean, almost all the 8,000 meter mountains have some degree of ambiguity about where the true summit is, from Annapurna to Broad Peak and the rest. So,
I mean, I was shocked. I didn't know Makalu had that, but we won't name names because I don't think we did do that. But I watched companies with clients stopping at what they call the client summit. They hung prayer flags. They made it look like a real summit, but I am here to tell you it was not the real summit. And, you know, Dorje Sonam Shopa and I fixed to the true summit, and it was very difficult to get there. And it's different, and it's important to talk about.
You know, and to your point, I actually had again, no names, but I had a very, very famous world-class climber contact me and talk about another world-class climber that claimed a summit, but to his knowledge, did not. So once again, I think that this sport is quickly becoming an issue of personal integrity, that every single individual has got to step up and be honest and transparent about not only what they achieved, but how they achieved it and who they achieved it with. And that's a good lead in for, I want you to, before we get, we're going to talk about the ski descent, but before we get in,
sure.
Talk about the Sherpas that you were climbing with. I know you have a long, long history with these guys. And
yeah.
And it was the three of you on the summit. The three of you made the first summit of the season on Mach.
Absolutely.
But talk about the Sherpas and the rope fixing and
Yeah.
Wax on about the Sherpas. I'm just going to sit back and listen. Well,
so important. Thanks for the opportunity. First of all, I've been so lucky through Russell Bryce and before Russell Bryce, another mentor of mine, Chris Warner. So I was tied into a Sherpa community very early in my career. I started going to Nepal in 1997. And by like 2000, kind of had like friends in the Sherpa community that I just wanted to keep working with and keep climbing with and things like that. My Sherpa team comes completely from the small town of Fortse, which obviously you know, it's where the Khumbu Climbing Center is. It's got an incredible view of Amit Ablam. They kind of feel ownership over that mountain, and that's a mountain I've had the opportunity to climb a lot. And my head Sherpa, Dorje Sonam, was Russell Bryce's head climbing Sherpa. So Purvatashi was kind of the head over all Sardar, and Dorje Sonam was this young rock star when I started climbing in the Himalayas, 20 years old and already had 6 summits of Everest and was always on the rope fixing team. And he and I just totally connected. So in 2012, when I broke off from Russ and started guiding 8,000 meter peaks on my own, Dorje offered to come as well and become my head Sherpa. And so we've just been on this path together really from the beginning. And back in those early years, 2010, 2011, those were the years I was fixing on Everest, kind of like assisting the rope fixers however I could, the Sherpa team. And it was just like, Dorje me. But for the past few years, that just hasn't been my role. I've been expedition leader. I've been doing different things. I haven't been rope fixing. And so this season was kind of unique. We went to Makalu. There were 4 main companies on the mountain, the largest team being Seven Summits Treks, and then us and a couple of other smaller teams. And Seven Summits Treks is obviously doing a lot of work on these different mountains. Their Sherpa are really strong and proud of their work. And so before we even left Kathmandu, the plan was Seven Summits Treks was going to do the rope fixing. We would kind of support them. As it turned out, because of, I think, timing and very challenging icy conditions, Seven Summits did do a lot of work, but the summit, basically summit day above Camp 4, just hadn't gotten fixed. In the season, we were coming into this amazing summit window starting around May 4th, May 5th, and I was losing my mind a little bit. There was like, we should get this done, like this is a good window. And yeah, of course we know it's a long season, but we also know crazy things happen, and so when there is a window, you want to take it. And so at that point, Alpenglow started like stepping in just a little bit more. We had 5 really strong Sherpa from Forte, led by Dorje Sonam, Sherpa who love rope fixing, who love to be in the front, things like that. And so we volunteered to kind of take the front. And as it turned out, Seven Summits Treks basically wanted to share. And so we, on the day, I think it was May 5th, we decided to try to rope fix to the summit. It ended up being 3 Seven Summit Sherpa, 2 Alpenglow Sherpa, Paulden, and someone named Nima, and Topo, who also, just loves climbing in the Himalaya. And his client was doing great and was on a rest period down at base camp. And so Topo was like, I'll just go up and see if they need help. And of course, was happy to join, and they made it all the way to probably something like 8,200 meters when they ran out of rope and were late in the day. Wow. But so that was the initial partnership. Seven Summits, Alpenglow, they did great work. They got very high, came back down, and because of that rope fixing in the good summer window, I had kind of in my head mentally said, we should try to go for the summit 3 or 4 days later. So I was already starting, putting things in motion, getting ready to go. When the rope didn't go to the summit, that was sort of a decision point of what to do. And kind of the second phase of Sherpa, Pasang Sona and Dorje were like, well, why don't we go finish it? And that sounded pretty fun to me to be up there with them again. And it just worked out. The other people who went for the summit that day definitely did not want to be in front rope fixing. Pioneer Sherpa, two of them actually carried rope for us. So we had some support. But at 7,900, we took over the front. I put on oxygen, which I might have told you before the expedition, like in my dream world, I'd ski a peak without an 8,000 meter peak without oxygen. I've never done it. Right. But K2 was recently skied without supplemental oxygen. So in my head, it was kind of a dream. But between the ropes not being fixed, carrying gear for that, breaking trail, and very importantly, the skiing conditions feeling at my limit. And I really wanted to have as many brain cells available for making decisions with some risk and exposure and hazard. I didn't think I was in a place to ski without oxygen. So I put on oxygen just on summit day. What that meant was I was strong and fast, and so were Dorje and Pasang. And we just had like this dream day, got to the top of the ropes. The weather wasn't great. It was a little bit whited out. But we ended up fixing the entire last, 250 meters or so to the summit, which turned out to be pretty exposed climbing along a knife edge ridge around a couple of false summits, really interesting climbing. And I'd like to say I was in the front leading it all, but Dorje was so excited and actually didn't really even give us a choice when we hit the summit ridge. He was like, I got this.
Stand back, guys.
Climbing along. And me and Pasang Soto, and Pasang, is only, 28. And so he's meant to be the young gun, and Dorje's the old guy. But Dorje was not giving up the front for those last couple pitches. And it was incredible. It took a couple hours to fix that last section. A few other climbers were waiting behind us, but Dorje got to the summit first of the season. And then Piso, Pasang, and I followed along and kind of, fixed all the anchors that he had threaded through and things like that, and got to be on top together.
That's super. That's super. I mean, the Sherpas take so much pride, and it's incredibly hard work and dangerous, carrying the ropes and the pickets and the bars and all that stuff. And it takes a lot of skills. So I think that often goes not it's appreciated, but I don't think people really internalize how difficult, how physical it is, putting in a fixed line.
100%. And the hazard should not be skipped as well. Like you said, like a lot of times on Everest or Lhotse in the normal season, the old ropes are visible because the mountains are so dry and they can kind of utilize them while also leading. But like a Makalu, no one had been up there in 3 years, if I have my facts right. And so they were truly leading, right? Like placing screws, clipping through gear, and doing it all on Korean, boat rope that you really don't want to fall on. They have great like heads as well for kind of the risk and hazard and making good decisions.
Yeah, sadly, I think it was 2019, a Sherpa died fixing the ropes in the Lhotse Kular at the very, he was leading, and I think he just lost his purchase and died. So it looked like, kind of following this from afar, that the mountain conditions, the weather was just all over the map this year. Kind of, it was great, and then it was horrible. Then you had a little short good time.
Yeah, overall, and this is something, this is funny because like me and Topo and Logan and Monica have been kind of debating this, especially with a lot of no oxygen climbers and kind of the challenges around that on Everest and K2 or Everest and Makalu, and thinking about no oxygen windows. My impression of the season is that we had incredibly stable weather overall, an incredible season. And there were a remarkable number of decently okay days that were appropriate for summiting with oxygen, days you kind of push through, but there were almost no like stunner days from what I saw in Makalu, like just perfect days. And so that was the challenge for people like Carla Perez or David Gottler, where it was like, there are plenty of good enough days, but as I was watching the forecast, like I just wasn't really seeing days where it was like, oh, there's going to be 5 to 10 kilometers of wind kind of thing. Like those just like perfect days. It was just like every day was 25 to 40 kilometers of wind and maybe some clouds in the afternoon, that kind of thing. Like, And so we struggled to find, to actually choose the perfect days. And, you know, caller on her first attempt without oxygen had to turn around. And it was definitely because the day was just a little too windy for what she wanted to accomplish and still come down with all her toes and things like that. So, but overall, looking at it in the grand scheme of all the seasons I've had over there, I felt like it was a pretty easy day as an expedition leader to look like you were pretty good at your job, because all the days worked for the normal project.
But, you know, back over on Everest, I mean, we're still going with, there's going to be more summits at the end of this week. This is Thursday. So over the weekend, it'll wrap up. I think the Icefall Doctors are taking the ladders out on Sunday. But overall, to your point, the winds just basically hovered between miles per hour, 20 to 30 miles per hour, almost the entire season. So it was right there within the envelope. And that allows so many people to spread out that we didn't have, you know, any type of, I don't think, significant traffic. Yeah. There's always somebody's going to say, well, you know, you weren't there. I was there. I was standing in line. I take that and I respect that. And
we know how much worse it could be as well.
Or that, you know, like Ben Jones, you know, he held up his team until 5 a.m. because the winds would not lie down on their summit bid for Alpine Ascents. So, so first off, with the disclaimer that I'm not a skier. I lost my ACL when I was 18 years old. I tried to go ski and all I did was just flip-flop my knee. So I said, I'm going to climb, not ski. So I don't know diddly squat about skiing, but I do know enough to know that I love this quote early on in your, I guess it was early on last month that you said, I'm going to read this. You put it on Instagram. You said, I can't decide whether to be super proud or super embarrassed of my ski from camp one at 21,000 feet down to the end of the snow at ABC. It felt hard and dangerous. I was also contrived and stupid, but I guess that's always been 8,000 meter peak skiing. I brought my skis all the way here, so I'm going to keep trying. Sounds like that first little foyer kind of tested your mettle a little bit.
Yeah, conditions, especially when we arrived, and I don't know if this was true on Everest, but conditions when we arrived were as dry as I've seen the Himalaya. Apparently, there was a lot of snow down low in the Himalaya this year, below 6,000 meters. Some of the passes to get to Makalu was still really snowy, but it must have been a very windy season up high. And I mean, there was just so much blue ice on the route that I was trying to ski. And where there wasn't blue ice and there had been snow, there were massive sun cups, like Penitentes and Aconcagua, I'm sure you've seen there, like they were up to like well above my knee. So my thighs, kind of 2 to 3 foot Penitente sun cups, like no one in their right mind would see conditions like this in the United States or in Europe and be like, let's go skiing. And so, you know, and that's not what 8,000 meter skiing is about. 8,000 meter skiing to me is like technical descending with skis on. It's about using all the tools you have as a mountaineer, alpinist, skier to like find ways to get down with your skis on safely. And if you get some good turns along the way, like I've actually show you once the sixth tallest mountain with like boot top powder for 6,000 vertical feet. But like, you know, that is not the norm. And so it was interesting being on Makalu. I was obviously there with a bunch of people trying without supplemental oxygen, as well as Alpenglow's client on oxygen. And I had my skis and I was all alone. I didn't have a ski partner. It's the first big mountain I've gone to without a ski partner. I couldn't find one that like had the money and the time and the skills and the interest. It just didn't line up. And so in those initial days, couple weeks, I really was kind of struggling with like, should I just be climbing without oxygen with that team? Because there's amazing partners that I have so much fun with, like a little bit like, what am I doing? But over those first 2 weeks, like I finished that ski and I was like, yeah, like someone would look at that from the outside and be like, that is stupid. But I wrote, was so proud that I'd figured it out and I didn't have to ever take my skis off. Like, and that's kind of one of the standards in the sport. The goal is to put your skis on the top and not take them off. Maybe you use a rope, maybe there's some shenanigans, but that's like the goal. And so I did that from 21 down, despite bad conditions. And I was like, I think I'm hooked. I think this is what I want to try to do. And then after that rotation, or maybe after the next rotation, actually Puja day, it started snowing, and it didn't snow much, but it snowed kind of like 2 to 4 inches a day for 3 or 4 days. You might remember that little cloudy, weird period. It wasn't enough to create any avalanche hazard, but it was enough to just soften things a little bit. And that's when I started getting more excited.
Yeah. Yeah. So were you on that first one, you're coming down? I mean, it looks like your skis were just scraping. So talk about it for the skiers out there, because I've had several people that asked me to talk to you after, because they're skiers and they really want to understand what type of technique did you use? I know when you're going down from the summit that you were kind of staying close to the ropes, so you know, you wouldn't get lost basically, but, you know, but also I guess it's a lifeline in some ways if you fell, you know, or really lost it. But talk about the techniques from a skier's perspective, how you navigated coming down.
Sure. So first of all, to the point of staying close to the ropes, like that on both Manaslu and Choyu, the other 8,000 meter peaks that I've skied, both of those trips, I went far away from the rope line because there was much better skiing to be had somewhere else. Yeah. And on Makalu, I had hoped to ski specifically between 25,000 feet and 22,000 feet in a different section away from the climb line. My summit day ended up being fully whited out by the time I was coming down because we took a long time rope fixing. We were slow. The skiing was quite technical up high. And so it turned out when I got to 25,000 feet, there was like, there's no way I'm going and exploring a completely different face of the mountain, even though we had used a drone and kind of figured out that it was probably skiable and things like that. There was enough snow, not ice. But when it came to it, it was like, in terms of lifeline, I wanted to be close enough to the line that I knew, and that there was kind of like this guide to go down. So I skied where I think it was harder in some ways because there were rock bands that I had to like work my way through on the climbing line. So I think in some ways the ski might've been harder, but it was definitely safer having that umbilical cord there. The other thing about the rope is, and I think I might have written this in one of my posts, like it was a lot of exposed no-fall skiing. So you're making jump turns and basically minimizing the time where you're gaining speed in the turn by hopping almost from edge to edge to edge. And for me, I just found it quite mentally taxing to be kind of on that very steep exposed terrain. So having the line there meant, even though I wanted to ski not on the line, when I got mentally worked, I could slide back to the line, clip in, take a break at an anchor and be like, okay, breathe for a little bit, have a drink of water, unclip, ski again. And then there were a few rock bands where I just couldn't get through safely. And so I could use a line as a hand line, or there was one section where I did a full 60 meter rappel, skis off, just a true, in the French couloir, it was just a true rock band, like a real rock band. So that's a little bit about the rope. And then, you know, skiing on pure blue ice is not a thing. On pure blue ice, your edges will not really hold. Yeah, but most of the ice on Makalu was kind of like aerated and whitish, if that makes sense. I mean, you've seen a lot of ice like that before. And so like where the was like aeration and the edges could get grip, I could continue to ski through those sections, but just very carefully. One ice axe the whole time, and not like a baby Everest like fake ice axe. I had a real ice climbing ice axe with a steel pick. And so when things in terms of techniques, that would be the other thing. If it got to the point where I didn't even feel like I wanted to make jump turns, but I wasn't on the rope, I could sidestep and use an axe just like you would ice climbing. So you got 3 points of contact, 2 ski edges, 1 ice axe, and you actually work your way down like that.
So did you were you using oxygen skiing down or not?
From the summit to 25,000 feet, I used oxygen. And then I took it off since I was, that's where I had acclimatized to. I had done no oxygen climbing to 25 during rotations and carrying loads with Sherpa. And the oxygen, of course, helps while skiing, but it's also a lot of weight and that kind of thing. And so I was excited to leave it behind at 25.
Yeah.
And another important sort of caveat to my climb is I absolutely, like, you know, I think a lot of times we read about professional, especially climbers, being like, no Sherpa support. Even maybe they had a broken trail or they had fixed ropes or ladders. But I specifically paid for and hired a Sherpa for this trip because I wanted to ski without all my camping gear on the back on the way down. So I carried almost nothing on the way down so that I could focus on the ski and had a Sherpa clean my camp for me. And I think that's an important caveat.
That absolutely, absolutely. Acknowledging those people that helped you, you know, accomplish this dream. So was it, how much out of breath did you get?
Way harder skiing than climbing. Yeah. Much, much, much harder. I wear a Coros watch. I wear Coros and I had a heart rate strap on for my climb. And if you look on Strava, my like heart rate data is much higher on the ski than the climb. And I think that's because literally it was thousands of jump turns. So because I've climbed my entire life, I'm pretty efficient at just like shuffling my feet along on 8,000 meter peak climbing. Like I don't use a lot of energy, right? It's all about efficiency. But on the way down, it was just brutal. If I was linking 10 turns in a row, I was like very proud of myself.
I was just going to ask you that very question. Did you ever get a chance to do any, you know, nice turns and, you know, put in the route? You know, take a picture of it and go, look at these beautiful tracks I just created.
Yeah, you know, on the summit day, because of that snow that had happened and then because it was getting so warm in May, I actually had good softening snow from camp two down. So from 2,500 feet down, I actually like got to ski and was super happy about it because I was so tired.
I can imagine.
It got a little bit easier. Yep.
So overall, you skied 8,000 vertical feet.
Yeah, it's almost 8,500 vertical feet with 160 meter rappel with my skis off, skis on the entire rest of the way.
Was that longer than Manaslu and Choyu?
It was. Choyu, the snow stops at like 21,000 feet. It's quite high, almost at Camp 1. And Manaslu also had a pretty high snow line the year I skied in 2011. So this was, probably my longest ski ever.
Did so when you were coming down, I guess you were passing people that were still going up. So I cannot imagine. This has got to be, you know, one of these crazy moments. You're climbing up a mountain and here comes this guy skiing down, almost going to run into you. I
mean, it was actually really fun. I mean, on the summit day, there were only, I think, 9 climbers on summit the day on May 9th. And those climbers all knew I was trying to ski that day and had picked that day because it wasn't going to be busy. So those climbers were like there were these three Georgian climbers climbing without oxygen. And they were just so excited for me. And then Carl and Nico were on their first attempt at their speed ascent. And so all those climbers up high were just like beyond excited. They were great energy. Then the funny thing was, though, going from Camp 3 at 25,000 feet down, that's when I hit all of the 7 summits team coming up. Oh. And that was a little bit more of a mixed team, right? Some people with a lot of experience, some people pretty new to 8,000 meter peaks and kind of like that terrain below Camp 3 on Makalu is really steep and it was firm, firm, firm. And so, I was making jump turns close to the rope and some people were like, wow, it's amazing, taking photos and stuff. And there were definitely people yelling at me like, clip on the rope. And, you know, and I don't totally blame them, you know, like one, they're worried for me probably, but they're also worried I'm going to fall and take them out. I tried to be respectful with people's opinions, but most of the energy was pretty excited and psyched. And the Sherpa, a lot of the Sherpa, I don't think have seen skiing on these big peaks before, not my team, but other teams. And there was a lot of excitement around.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what did the Sherpas, they must have just shaken their head and go, you know, crazy
America. Yeah, I mean, I do think they think it's crazy, but I also think anyone working in the Himalaya now is used to crazy, kind of unusual stuff happening. Like I feel like the industry and the sport is getting more and more unusual, for lack of another word. And so
it's unique.
Shake their head to lots of things.
Yeah, it's becoming unique. I've got to say that. So I know you. Yeah, you've been. What? How old were you when you first put a pair of skis on?
So I actually was not as young as a lot of my friends. You know, I think in the pro skiing world, if you don't start at two, you miss the boat. Yeah. You know, I moved to the United States when I was six and ended up walking distance from a little 800-foot ski hill in Massachusetts called Mount Wachusett. And so, like, I feel like the day we landed and moved there, I started skiing, and it became my, like, total passion growing up, more than climbing. I would just finish school, do my homework, and then they had night skiing at Mount Wachusett, and I would get there by 4 or 5 p.m. and ski until 8, just every day, all winter. So 6 years old.
And this had to have an influence on UNM living in Tahoe now. So
absolutely. I dragged her out here so we could have skiing as part of our world.
The funny thing is,
she started skiing at age 2, and her dad was convinced that she was going to be a pro skier. That was his path for her. And so from 2 until 14, she was ski racing. And then discovered climbing at 12. And by the age 14, she told her dad she was never skiing again, and she was focusing on climbing. But the funny thing is, she had incredible fundamentals from that first 10 years of ski racing. So when she started skiing again at age 25, she got very good very quickly. And she was actually just on a really high-end pro skier North Face trip to Baffin Island for the last month while I was on Makalu. And her skiing, her photos look a lot more fun than mine, but she was also skiing very high consequence, steep couloirs in big mountains.
So let me get this straight. So your wife, Emily Harrington, has taught you how to do big wall rock climbing and how to do extreme skiing. Do I have that right?
I'm not going to go quite that far, but she's certainly a very good skier.
So the reason I wanted to know when you started skiing was that obviously, I mean, you've got to have extraordinary skills to be able to navigate a steep terrain with rocky faces outcropping and, you know, those type of whiteout conditions. Did you ever almost bite it?
No, on this trip, never almost blew it. I thought a lot about risk on this trip. And that's why I decided to put on oxygen, was to have extra strength and extra brain power to make good decisions. And again, when I felt like I was getting close to that edge, I went back to the rope. And that also allows for a purer ski descent one day with less rope use or no rope use. I think Makalu in the right conditions in the autumn could be skied from top to bottom without ropes. In terms of risk, I took some significant risk in this ski descent. But when I started to have that feeling I might blow it here, I went back to the rope.
So you think that top ridge is skiable in the right conditions?
Yeah, so the 15 meters that I didn't ski was not because I thought it was impossible. It was quite technical, probably almost 60 degrees and very firm. Mm-hmm. But the problem was that there were 9 climbers waiting to go up. And on Makalu, you basically go one at a time to the summit. And so I would have had to wait for 9 climbers who were stacked up to get out of the way before I could descend. And I'd already been on the summit ridge for 2 hours fixing, and my feet were cold, and I was just a little concerned. And so climbing, you've seen this. I could go down the rope and kind of hand over hand around them and get going.
Right.
But on skis, I couldn't have done that. And so that's why I skipped. I went around those 8-9 climbers waiting to go to the true summit and then put on my skis and skied. And so for sure that's skiable. The 60 meter rappel that I did in the middle of the French couloir at 8,200 meters, only because I have photos from the autumn and that rock band wasn't there. So I think it can be skiable in the autumn. It just needs a lot of snow and a lot of wet monsoon snow, not light powder.
Wow. So you had a pretty world-class team that you worked with. I mean, and then Carla and Topo just, they just summited, what, 2 days ago or something?
2 days ago.
So yeah. Tell us about your team. And also I want to talk a little bit about Carl and Nico and their fastest known time.
Yeah, so, you know, Alpenglow Expeditions, basically when we decided not, we couldn't go to the north side of Everest. We didn't want to go to the south side of Everest. Topo and I got excited to basically sell a trip for Alpenglow to Makalu. My plan was to guide this spread, not to do a personal project. And that was Topo's plan as well. And I had high hopes that we'd have a half dozen clients on Makalu this spring. As it turned out, we ended up with only one private client. And the trip couldn't have run probably unless we joined Seven Summits Tracks or something like that. And so really starting when we realized that last fall or this winter, we started scrambling and trying to figure out how to put together a trip. And so I and Carla and some other friends like Carla and Nico started hitting up our sponsors and begging and pleading, could we go do something fun there? And as it turned out, we ended up with five athletes trying to do kind of like personal projects alongside the Alpenglow team. And that enabled Alpenglow to run the trip, our client to get to go and do this personal private climb with Topo. And of course, I and Carla and Nico, we're all excited about our projects. But so I feel very lucky to have that support from companies like Eddie Bauer. And but that's how the trip came about. What it meant was we had some really fun people on the trip. Christina, our client with Alpenglow, has done 3 8,000-meter peaks with us before. She wanted to come in and do like a with oxygen climb, but pretty quickly, and she just crushed it. Like they just did everything right. They pre-acclimatized well. They went to the Khumbu and did a big loop and ran around to get some more acclimatization. Flew to ABC on Makalu and were just ready to rock and roll. So they did great. Carla climbing without supplemental oxygen. She's got a goal to do the 5 tallest peak, so maybe not all 14, but the 5 tallest without supplemental oxygen. She's done Everest and K2, attempted Kanchenjunga, but unsuccessfully, and then came to Makalu. And as you said, like we've talked about Carla before, she just has incredible tenacity. She's quiet. She loves the mountains so much, but just like put the work in. When as like me and Carla and Nico were trying to figure out ways to avoid sleeping at 7,500 meters and being uncomfortable and eating dehydrated food, Carla was like, I'm going to do 6 more nights up there because I know that's what my body needs. And it doesn't matter how much I suffer. Like she's such a role model to me of like being willing to put the effort in and the suffering. And she demonstrated that again when she failed on May 12th, turned around at 8:03 because she thought she might lose her toes and was like, she did the right thing. She came down, she didn't blow it. And then was like, of course I'm staying. Like there's no question that I'm gonna stay and suffer and recover. And it doesn't matter if Alpenglow's satellite internet and heaters and all these creature comforts are leaving. She's like, I'm staying. And it was so proud. So that's Carla.
I was so impressed at how she wrote about that decision to turn around. I think it was on Instagram, but you know, it was so eloquent. It was so humble. It was so real, transparent, you know, all the stuff we talked about at the beginning, but it really showed kind of what, you know, what her character is. And then, so I was so happy that, you know, she went back and got it. So what about the
and then Carla Nico.
Yeah. Yeah. This fastest known time thing.
Yeah. So Carl Egloff and Nicholas Miranda, both Ecuadorians, super strong mountain guides. I've known them from guiding in Ecuador for some time. And basically, Carl and I ended up hanging out during my wedding this past winter. He was one of the guides of the wedding climb and then, you know, stayed and hung out with us. And he has been progressively breaking Seven Summits records, so speed records, fastest known times, FKTs. And this is a growing side of the sport, I would say, as it becomes harder, I think, to find new unclimbed routes or new unclimbed mountains. I think there's a natural progression to the athletic side of 8,000 meter peak climbing or big mountain climbing, and speed is one way to demonstrate that. So there's been races on mountains like Mont Blanc and Elbrus and things like that for a long time, and really Kilian Jornet kind of brought some of that when he attempted to break the speed record on Everest. And so Carl, I think, has the speed record as the fastest known times on 4 of the 7 summits at this point, but he had never been to 8,000 meters. And so if he wants to do all 7, he wanted to go to Ecuador. Like, he's quite humble and he wanted to go to Ecuador with 8,000 meter peak experience. And so his idea was to attempt to break the FKT on Makalu and kind of learn how 8,000 meter peaks work with Sherpa, work with an expedition leader like Alpenglow, see how his body reacts, see what acclimatization he needs to do, because it is different for everyone. Yeah. And so he came to Makalu with his climbing partner, Nico, and they were just fantastic, like sucking in knowledge from all the more experienced climbers and Sherpa there, but also being willing to try their own things and kind of push because they know what works for their bodies. They made an initial attempt on my summit day on May 9th to see if they could break the FKT, but they very clearly called it a acclimatization rotation because they also, I think, wanted to be humble about it. And they made it to, I think, I think I saw them at 7,900 meters that day. Maybe they went to about 8 or something like that. And they just knew they were getting too late in the day, slowing down more than they had expected, much more than they had ever slowed down on Aconcagua or anything like that. And they turned around and came down. And an interesting thing I noticed with Killian when he did his record attempts on Everest, and then with Carl, like, for me, when I go to 8,000 meters, I need a week at least to recover. If I went to 8,000 without oxygen, I've done it a couple of times on Everest, going to the South Col with Sherpa, obviously my no oxygen attempts on K2 and Everest. Like, I go to 8, I need a week. These guys, they just recover in a really different way than I think normal human beings do. And so when they told me they were thinking of turning around after failing on the 9th and attempting on the 12th, to me, it was like, you guys aren't ready. There's no way, regardless of what the weather is or this or that. And I was wrong. They were able to recover just 3 days later and go from advanced base camp at 19,000 feet to the summit at almost 28,000 feet and back to ABC. And they did up in 17 hours and round trip in, I think, 26 hours, only 3 days after essentially having climbed, you know, Choyu.
Yeah.
I find it remarkable.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the best indications of fitness is how fast you recover. And
you're saying I'm not fit, Alan.
No, I'm saying these guys are in a class of their own, is what I'm saying.
A completely different class. And I think I see some talk, and of course there's always talk online and on Twitter. I see some people thinking that this is not good for our sport, like speed and fastest known times. I think bringing in the athleticism of professional runners and people who have had a lifetime of coaching and nutrition and things that climbers really haven't had. Like, I think I probably said this to you before, like when I grew up in climbing, it was just who suffered the most. That was the best climber.
You're a dirt bagger. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think our sport is going to change for the better as we bring in people who have this totally different level of athletic ability, provided they're willing to build the skills, go with experienced teams, have safety nets around them if they're really pushing these limits, and be respectful of the mountains, because the mountains are, you can't just DQ, right? You can't just go out of the race at the aid station. So there is a humility, I think, that's important. But I think they're going to change our sport for the better and show us things that we haven't realized are possible.
So I want to wrap up with this one last question, and actually feeds into what you were just talking about with Carl and Nico. So this year we saw an unprecedented number of multi 8,000 meter summits. Yes. I mean, it's Carla from Norway, you know, yep. she got all of them except for, I think she's going to get Makalu tonight. She may already have done it. And then, you know, you've got multiple people that did Kamachanga, Annapurna. So, and what they did though, is that they use an interesting technique with the Sherpas basically going in and overpowering the mountain, you know, maybe 7-8 of these incredibly strong Sherpas, fix the ropes to the summit, establish the camps, stock them with food, fuel, oxygen, and then, you know, the window comes and off they go. the climbers go up, and you have this massive, you know, group that goes up, and then they come back down and they fly by helicopter to the next base camp, and then they just, you know, it's rinse and repeat. Is that good or bad?
I love that you saved this for last. I was wondering if we were going to talk about this, because it's all I've been talking about for 2 months with my guides, with my friends, with Monica, because somehow I haven't been in the Himalaya for 3 years because of COVID and life. And I came back and it's changed. And so now maybe I'm the grumpy old guy that Russell Bryce was to me, right? So I want to be aware that change is hard, and so I don't want to automatically just shut it down. But what I'm concerned about, what I saw or what I feel like isn't resonating with me, like Alpenglow uses helis, Alpenglow does rapid ascent, Alpenglow has sped up trips, and we use a lot of support, 1.5 Sherpa to 1 client, you know, we do a lot of these things, and maybe we even started some of it or pushed the limit, and some companies didn't love where we were pushing the sport or the limit. But what I saw this season, and Makalu, everything you just said, but also even people coming to go for a summit push, and then the weather wasn't quite right or something, or the ropes weren't in, and they flew back out. Kathmandu waited and then flew back in. And so not only multiple peaks, but just there's almost a complete dissociation from the work it takes to be successful on a mountain and the summit climb. And that's where I'm not ready to see the sport go. Like, even though we do different jobs and the Sherpa do work and the guides do work and the clients do different work, with there and feeling the risk and the hard work and the exposure, and I truly feel like my clients and my Sherpa feel like a team.
Yeah.
And appreciate each other and want to party together at the end. And what I see happening is a complete separation of that. There's a staff doing all the work, and then there's a drop in and a summit and a pull out, to the point where I saw people summit, come to base camp, and 8 hours later fly out. Right. No celebration, no like, and I'm just not ready to see the sport go there. I still think we need to be teams, and we need to share that hard work, and so that's where I'm putting the value. I don't think we're going to slow it down, though. I can tell you, you know, I think I told you 5 years ago, it was like, oh shoot, 25% of the people who call Alpenglow now don't want to climb Everest, they want to climb K2. That happened a few years ago, like K2 was the new cool mountain. Now half of the phone calls of new people coming into the office are only interested if they can climb multiple 8,000 meter peaks back to back to back. And so I see that trend happening. I think it's going to continue happening. I think it might really change how we run trips, because Alpenglow is not going to build 5 different base camps. And so basically, if we want to accept a client that wants to do that, you almost have to go with one of the large Nepali companies, and you could be a pod inside of it with your own guide and your own this and your own that, but you're going to use the logistics that are built on each mountain. And I'm not ready to see the sport or to see Alpenglow go that way, but I do see the pull towards multiple mountains. And of course we understand it, right? I'm talking a lot here. Sorry, Alan, but like, we can understand it's so much work to acclimatize for one mountain. It seems logical. Like, well, of course I should just go do another one. It's only an extra 5 days, or it's only an extra this. To me, it really felt like it takes away what I love about these mountain climbs.
I appreciate you talking about that from that perspective, especially as an operator. I think the other wild card that we saw this year, and very, very little talked about publicly, was the use of oxygen. And, you know, a lot of these, it used to be that it was really just Everest where oxygen was used, supplemental oxygen, and the rest of the 8,000ers were climbed more, you know, cleanly. But this year, I even heard about people using oxygen from base camp on their second 8,000er. So
absolutely.
And when that happens, you know, I think you have to separate you know, this is where style comes in. I've always kind of bristled at this discussion around style and the oxygen, no oxygen snob wars, you know, but I think this now it takes it back center stage, and there is a time and place. People are now using supplemental oxygen below what is the equivalent of the summit of Aconcagua. And
oh, you would, 100. The norm would on Makalu was put it on at 6.4.
Yeah, so you would never go to Aconcagua and oxygen. But sorry, go ahead.
I said that's like the summit of Chimborazo in Ecuador, 6.4. You know, I mean, it's so low. So we're agreeing. But the one caveat I'd say to what you just said is oxygen usage on Aconcagua is now starting. So you are now starting to see oxygen use on Aconcagua. And I think we're going to see it continue to grow.
Well, full disclosure, I use natural oxygen on my Colorado 14ers. So, Adrian, it's always a pleasure. It's an congratulations, welcome home, and
thank you.
And I'm not going to ask you the proverbial what's next question, because I know you've got a long list.
And you know, I'll probably give you some answer about how I'm trying to be content in this one before I move to the next. So, thanks. There'll be more fun to come. Alpenglow is going to Gasherbrum 2 this summer with Topo, with 5 climbers. So that's sort of our first entry into Pakistan from a guiding perspective. And we're really excited about it, especially with Cho Yu not being an option right now. Gasherbrum 2 for us is a safe and interesting and fun option for a first 8,000 meter peak, which we still require before Everest. So watch for us on G2 this summer.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I've always considered Choi, Manaslu, and G2 the three most attainable. I'll never say easy, but attainable 8,000ers. So fun. I'll have a great time. I'm jealous trekking back up through the Baltero. That's just a crazy place. I love it.
It's unbelievable. I look forward to getting back there.
All right. Thanks again.
Great. Thanks, Alan. I appreciate it. And thanks for all the coverage this season.
Always.
It was great to read about Everest when I couldn't be there.
Well, you earned and deserved the coverage again. Well done to the entire team, from Sherpas to Cooks to everybody else. All right.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
Bye.